This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. On Capitol Hill this week, leaders of the Congressional Committee looking into the pre-war intelligence on Iraq released a harshly critical letter to CIA Director George Tenet, describing the agency's work as circumstantial and fragmentary. Republican Representative Porter Goss of Florida joined Democrat Jane Harman, a representative from California, in signing the letter, which said the CIA's lack of specific intelligence hampered their ability to provide policymakers with a better assessment of the situation regarding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Goss, a former member of the CIA, has always been a strong supporter of the intelligence community. Meanwhile, a few blocks down Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House is disputing claims that a senior administration official leaked the identity of a CIA agent in order to discredit her husband. The intelligence agency has joined Democratic lawmakers in calling for an investigation of the incident. Both stories shed light on the relationship between the CIA, the administration, and Congress. We'll be discussing the politics of intelligence today on Talk of the Nation. If you have a question about the news you've been hearing about the intelligence community, give us a call here in Washington at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And, of course, our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to start with a developing story that's been making headlines for the past few days. That is the accusations that White House officials leaked the name of a CIA operative in an attempt to discredit her husband's findings about Saddam Hussein's nuclear ambitions. With us now is Dana Priest. She's the national security reporter with The Washington Post. She joins us from her office in the Pentagon in Virginia. Thanks for being with us, Dana.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Well, Janet, this story right now is very hot. It's on the front pages all over the place, but it's been simmering for a while. Can you tell us how we got to this point?
Well, we got to the point thanks to columnist Robert Novak, who wrote about it and discussed the fact that some of his sources were senior administration officials. These were sources, he said, told him the story that he believed about the wife of Joe Wilson, who was a former ambassador to Niger, who the CIA had sent to Niger to try to check out the allegation that Iraq had tried to purchase uranium ore from Niger. He came back with an answer that said, no, that probably didn't happen. Eventually started talking publicly about it. The administration didn't quite like that because it didn't fit into their view up to that point that was a legitimate piece of information. He was discrediting that. And then there were people who told Novak that it was his wife's idea to send him on the trip. She worked at the agency, and this is her name. Turns out that she was a director of operations employee, which means she was undercover, had worked abroad for a number of years, back in Washington now doing some analytical work. But the fact that he printed her name caused the agency to take what could be considered their normal response in that case, which is to first alert the Justice Department that an unauthorized leak of classified information, which was her name, occurred. And then several, probably weeks later, they sent a letter from the General Counsel's Office of the CIA to the Justice Department asking them to investigate. And soon after that, they answered a number of questions, 11 questions to be precise, about the person, about the circumstances as they knew it, which they say they didn't know much about it except that it appeared in the newspaper. This weekend, other people told the Washington Post, my colleague Mike Allen and I did a story quoting someone in the administration talking about the issue and how upset there certain people within the administration were that someone from the administration might have done this. What makes it also interesting and unusual is that apparently a number of other reporters, probably four or five other reporters, were called at the same time or around the same time Novak was called with, we believe, with the same sort of information. Why they didn't choose to use it, we don't know. They've, of course, not named their sources, which I wouldn't expect them to do. But it does insinuate, at least, that there was a campaign on the part of somebody to get this information in print, probably to discredit Wilson's comments to begin with.
All right, now, How serious is this for the White House? Democratic lawmakers are calling for an independent investigation. How vulnerable is the White House on this?
Well, it could be quite serious, but we don't know. If it turns out that there was a White House official who did this, then that would be very serious because, of course, Wilson was a diplomat and worked with classified information when he was. Anyone who would know his wife probably worked in the national security arena. Therefore, you would think that they would know the damage that could be done by publicizing the name of somebody who is still undercover. And that is where, you know, the real damage would be, that someone in the White House would do something like that. Now, of course, if it wasn't somebody in the White House, then I think it could blow over pretty quickly. One would think that the White House would try to get out in front of it. Maybe they did that today when they said no one here did that.
Let me ask you to clarify something for us. Is Wilson's wife, is she still undercover, or was she undercover at the time that?
Yes. Both questions' answer is yes. Of course, now that her name's out, it's a little hard to be undercover. But
right, exactly.
Yes, she was. When you work undercover, usually in the Directorate of Operations, even when you cross over to the other side, the analytics side, which most of the people in the analytics side are not undercover, but it depends. You don't lose your cover unless your career looks like it's going to, you know, end there. You'll always be in analysis. They need to maintain that facade so that if you go back overseas, you will not have broken the cover. So the whole decision about whether to remove somebody's cover is a very lengthy one that they take very seriously, as you can imagine, and it involves both what the person's career will be like from then on and what their previous contacts have been. So if they judge it to be, even though you're going to work in non-classified areas even, if they judge that it would be damaging to national security or to the projects that you worked on previously to remove your cover, they'll still maintain it.
And yeah. So this is a very personal fight, and Ambassador Wilson has been very public in his criticism of the White House. He spoke last night. He's also been mentioning one of President Bush's top officials specifically in relation to this. He was on NPR's All Things Considered last night. We are going to hear some tape from Ambassador Wilson last night.
I don't know for a fact that Karl Rove either leaked the information or authorized it. I do have credible sources who have indicated to me that Karl Rove, at a minimum, condoned it and certainly did nothing to stop the leak for the first 8 days that it was going around.
Dana, why is Ambassador Wilson so focused on Karl Rove in this?
Well, I think the fact is that he believed from his sources, which he's not told us who exactly they are, but he believed that that's who the leaker was. Now he's saying he believes it, but he doesn't have proof. Why he believes it, again, I think he was told that by people, but it was secondhand. So he is backing off of that a little bit, and we'll just have to see. You know, the entire Washington press corps is trying to get to the bottom of this, and it's not easy because it's a fairly disciplined White House, and you have now the official spokesman of the White House denying that anyone from the White House was involved. So that'll make it harder to find out and get to the bottom of it, and that's why the Justice Department is probably the best bet. But that's also why, and politics definitely comes into this, why Democrats are calling for an independent counsel, because they don't believe that, as they say, John Ashcroft's Justice Department will get to the bottom of this.
All right, let's take a call. Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Good morning. Good afternoon. First of all, a little background. I spent 20 years working with all the alphabet agencies. When I left the United States Air Force, I signed an oath never to reveal some or most of the things that I had access to. I consider what has happened here to be treason. We just put an FBI agent in jail. There are a variety of military and civilian betrayers of the oath that they swear who are serving time. I think particularly of Jason Pollard and people like that. And quite frankly, whoever did it in the White House, and I can almost guarantee you that's where it came from. And I certainly wouldn't put it past Karl Rove, knowing what I know about him. So I would like a comment from the political pundit if you will, about what's going on in Washington, because I'm out here in California, a long way removed from it, but what are they trying to do to our intelligence agencies?
All right, Dana, maybe you can respond. Thanks for your call, Robert.
All right.
Dana,
I'll take the call answer off the air.
Thanks so much.
Well, I have to first clarify, I'm not a political pundit. I write about intelligence issues, and politics is sort of the sideline that everyone has to cover in Washington. What's going on? I think if you do believe that the White House was involved, then the assumption would be that they did it to discredit Wilson. Now, whether the person who, it's conceivable that the person who gave him the name didn't know that she was undercover. And it's conceivable that even if they did, they thought discrediting him was a bigger issue than her identity, although that would be, as he suggests, a very irresponsible move. A lot of people, even if you buy the worst-case scenario, Joe Wilson's assertions about Niger certainly were not key to the larger question of the validity and credibility of pre-war intelligence. They are just a minor bit to it all. So if it turns out it is someone at the White House, it would be a very telling point on how vindictive people are. Then again, it might not turn out to be that way, and it might turn out to be quite different.
Dana, before you have to go, let's move to the other big story, intelligence story, the issue brewing on the Hill, the letter sent by leaders of the House Committee on Intelligence to CIA Chief George Tenet, criticizing the gathering and handling of pre-war intelligence on Iraq. What's the significance of that letter?
Well, that's potentially much more significant for the larger national security issues that we're facing right now, including the reconstruction of Iraq and international support for George Bush's foreign policy. I say that because it all goes to the point of how immediate was the threat from Iraq. And just to put it briefly, the two leaders of the House Intelligence Committee had been looking at 19 volumes of classified information given to them by George Tenet. They've spent 4 months going over it. It was the information that was the underlying data to support what was called the National Intelligence Estimate, the key document used by policymakers to decide for themselves how big a threat Saddam Hussein was. And mainly what they found is that the information was derived from sources that were pre-1998 when the UN inspectors left, largely because the United States was about to bomb Iraq. They left the country. Those on-the-ground sources were no longer there. They found a dearth of direct human informants who could give them good information. They found that a lot of it was circumstantial, inferential, sporadic, and criticized the agency for coming to what they believe were some conclusions that cannot be supported by the underlying information.
Now, Porter Goss of Florida, one of the people who signed this letter, is a big supporter of the intelligence community. So that's significant, too, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think they would both say they are. Porter Goss has a caveated paragraph in there that says, I don't think that they misrepresented the intelligence. It's unclear what exactly he means, given all of the negative comments he made in the letter. But I think what he means is he wants to direct his attention at making the agency better rather than just criticizing it, and understands the weakness inherent when you don't have the kind of informant on the ground truth, as he says, in a situation like Iraq. Nonetheless, he uses very strong language with her to criticize what happened.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Dana.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Dana Priest is the Washington Post national security reporter. We're talking about the conflict between politics and intelligence. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. With us now from our studios at NPR West in Culver City, California, is NPR correspondent Mike Schuster, who's also been following these stories for NPR. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Hi, Lynn.
Mike, has the CIA responded yet to this letter that was sent by the House Intelligence Committee?
I think that there has been some response, but I doubt that it's the full response that the CIA will give. When the Washington Post disclosed that this letter had been sent, I think the Washington Post did that on Sunday, the CIA was asked to comment, and a CIA spokesman actually went on the record and said that the remarks of the two members of Congress were themselves, in effect, incomplete, and that the process of gathering and analyzing intelligence before the war in Iraq, from the CIA's point of view, had maintained its integrity, and that there was much more to say about it than what had been said by the two members of Congress.
Who's on the defensive here? Is it the White House or the CIA or both?
I think it's everybody, Lynn, and I don't think that this defensiveness has started now. If you go back to the couple of months before the United States invasion of Iraq, there was a very, very robust debate publicly about the intelligence, about whether the things that President Bush and his senior foreign policy aides were saying about the threat in Iraq were true. And there were a number of leaks before the invasion began that suggested that the CIA and other elements in the defense, other elements in the intelligence community, weren't all that sure about just what kind of threat existed in Iraq from weapons of mass destruction. There were a lot of questions raised at the time. I think what's true is that that defensiveness has continued and has essentially been magnified because of the fact that since the war, no weapons of mass destruction or no significant weapons of mass destruction have been found. So that puts the pressure on both the CIA, the White House, the Pentagon as well. And as more weeks go past without a strong case being made that there was, in fact, an imminent or a gathering threat, as members of the administration said, this pressure is bound to put both the White House and the intelligence community on the defensive.
And what that letter, from what I've read about it, a lot of what that letter says is that the intelligence was old, that they relied on old information and they weren't able to get anything new in order to make their assessments, and that therefore Congress feels, I have a sense that some members of Congress, many members of Congress perhaps, feel that they weren't getting good information.
Well, I think that that's true. The intelligence community and the administration tried to make out before the war that there had been a continuing process of gathering intelligence that was good. And in fact, there are a number of statements from Vice President Cheney and others in the administration in the weeks before the war that suggested that the administration had very current and very good intelligence that that Saddam Hussein and his government were reconstituting weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. And what's interesting about this issue of whether there was any new intelligence after 1998, when the weapons inspectors were banned from Iraq, is that when weapons inspectors went back, the flow of intelligence began again. There were hundreds of UN weapons inspectors for a couple of months in Iraq, including inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency. And they were giving the world and the United States much more information about what they were finding or not finding. But it wasn't information or intelligence that suited, that seemed to suit the purpose of the administration, which is to make the case that there was a serious threat. So this letter seems to suggest that the best intelligence that the United States had on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was from UN weapons inspectors before 1998, and that would imply that there was good intelligence coming, flowing from them when they went back as well.
We're talking about the intelligence community and the politics of intelligence, particularly with regards to the gathering of intelligence prior to the U.S. decision to go into war against Iraq. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And we're going to take a call now, Mike, from Steve in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My point is pretty simple. I believe that this recent report is a very positive development, of course, because it simply confirms what we've known for a long time, that the allegations made about Iraq having so-called weapons of mass destruction were largely false, if not outright distortions of the real record. But I feel that what the committee is doing is really kind of covering its own tracks, and so is the media, too. By playing up this story now, it looks like, oh, they're revealing all this new information, when in fact, none of the information is new. We knew about this very well before the war, and the Congress should have been doing its job before the war and making it clear to the American public that the stories that we were getting about Iraq were largely false, if not complete outright lies. And, I mean, you think of, for instance, when Colin Powell did his speech at the UN, okay? You never heard anyone in the United States, congressman or the media, calling him on the use of the fake dossier, the plagiarism, and the fake claims. But in Britain, the British public, after Powell's speech, became very aware of how weak the American case was. And so, I mean, you know, you didn't hear about this on, you didn't hear any guests on Talk of the Nation, for instance, criticizing Powell. You only heard over and over Powell's brilliant speech. But the fact is, what is happening now is that the politicians and media are covering for the fact that they didn't do their job before the war.
Okay, Vin, we're going to let Mike respond to that. Thanks for your call, Steve. Any reaction to that, Mike?
Well, I just think that the caller is mischaracterizing the nature of the debate that preceded the war. The administration made its case, but there were plenty of critics, both in the Congress and in the media, that raised questions, if not outright contradicted the things that that the members of the administration were saying. I don't think that this was an easy sell for the administration before the war, and it's become a much more difficult sell after the war.
All right, we want to bring in a new guest now. The current fights over pre-war intelligence and possible White House leaks of CIA information take place at the intersection of intelligence and politics. Congress and presidential administrations rely heavily on the intelligence agencies to bring them the information that shapes foreign policy. That means this isn't the first time that the CIA has found itself center stage in policy disputes. Joining us now from his home in McLean, Virginia, is Vince Canestraro, a former CIA chief of counterterrorism and a 27-year veteran of the agency. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Is having your work debated on Capitol Hill and in the pages of the Washington Post standard for the CIA, or is this an extraordinary time for the agency?
Well, it seems to happen in cycles. It is extraordinary at this point, but it's happened before. And it's, in many respects, very healthy to have this kind of debate because, after all, we committed a large force of men and women to combat in Iraq on the basis, in part, of some intelligence information. And now the question is whether the intelligence that drove the policy or was supposed to have driven the policy was accurate and was well-founded. One of the problems in this debate is that when we talk about the intelligence community, we tend to talk about CIA specifically and sometimes DIA, which is the intelligence agency of the military. But there was other intelligence information that was not corroborated by the intelligence community, didn't go through intelligence community channels, that was also used to inform the policy debates in the Bush administration. And by that I mean the Defense Department's own operation of the Iraqi National Congress. There was a congressionally appropriated fund of $100 million, and part of that money was used to finance the intelligence gathering activities of Ahmed Chalabi and the INC, the Iraqi oppositionists. That information didn't necessarily go directly to the intelligence community. It went directly to the civilian policymakers within the Pentagon. And a lot of that information, we found out later, was used to determine parts of the planning for the invasion of Iraq and for post-Iraq planning. And clearly that was deficient. And a lot of the information about weapons of mass destruction to be found in Iraq derived from Ahmed Chalabi and the INC. And we know now that from the David Kaye inspection that much of it was not founded.
Well, what about the intersection of politics and intelligence? I mean, are there firewalls in place to prevent the goals of a specific administration from influencing intelligence gathering and analysis?
In theory, there are. In theory, the practice should be that the intelligence agencies report information on priority subjects, but that they provide that information on a this-is-what-we-have-found basis to the policymakers, and the policymakers are supposed to use the product of that intelligence investigation to formulate policies. What we have here is a complete reversal of the normal process, because the administration decided very early on that it would invade Iraq, because that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were dangers, were national security risk. And so the intelligence community was under pressure to find the supporting information to provide a foundation for a policy decision already made. That's not the normal way of doing it. So what you had was a great deal of pressure on the intelligence community to come up with information that would support policy positions already adopted. In many cases, there was certainly a feeling within some elements of the CIA, for example, that there was pressure and that there was some intimidation. And it came from some parts of the Pentagon, in particular, and the Vice President's office, that were normally antagonistic towards CIA. There was a certain amount of contempt among some of the civilian policymakers towards the Central Intelligence Agency and its product as being too soft, too squishy, too liberal, not hard enough. So you had these pressures circulating all the time. So there is a real question of whether the intelligence community leaned over too far in the direction of providing information that the policymakers wanted to hear rather than should have heard.
Following up on that, there's an email here asking whether the White House was using its own intelligence team to support the case for war because the administration mistrusted the intelligence from the CIA.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I think that's exactly the case. In many cases, the information derived from the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon from its own intelligence resources, meaning the INC and Ahmad Chalabi in particular, was at variance with what CIA could support. Now, that's not to give CIA a free pass here. I mean, it's clear from the Intelligence Committee, particularly the House Intelligence Committee review, the CIA's intelligence was deficient. It wasn't good enough. And that was one of the problems. It wasn't, you can't really fight an opposite view if you don't have your own resources and your own reporting. If a lot of CIA's resources were diminished in Iraq because they lost a lot of the human assets on the ground in 1996 during an abortive coup against Saddam Hussein, they hadn't been able to reconstitute that network. So they were dependent on older information, particularly information, as Dana Priest noted, prior to 1998 when the weapons inspectors were still there.
Well, if that's the heart of or a core of the criticism that's being leveled at the CIA, how unusual is that to rely on old information, rely on old intelligence to make
I think what it shows is that the information was not well-founded enough on which to base a decision to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the key point. Do you send young men and women off to fight a war on the basis of information which is not complete, which is not exhaustive, which in some cases is questionable, and in some cases is informed from parallel lines of intelligence collection that have not been vetted by the intelligence community? And I think those are serious questions to be debated.
Vince Canestraro is a former CIA chief of counterterrorism operations and analysis. We're also talking with NPR correspondent Mike Schuster. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're going to take a call now from Pod, I think it is, in Walterboro, South Carolina. Hi.
Hi, Lynn. My question is, I was a reporter once, and I called the CIA headquarters, and I asked if it is legal to reveal the name of a CIA agent, and I was told, no, that's against the law. So my question is Robert Novak not in violation of the law?
Vince?
Yeah, well, there is the Identities Act, which was adopted, I believe, in 1982, which makes it a crime to reveal to the media, in other words, a official who has knowledge, classified knowledge, revealing the identity of a covert operative to the media. And that would mean the person or persons who leaked the information to Novak would be at risk, not the media recipient, him or herself.
Okay. And Lynn, maybe I can add that, in fact, the Justice Department contacted the office of the White House counsel last night and informed the White House that it had begun an investigation of this matter. And this morning, the White House counsel informed the staff of the White House to preserve all necessary and relevant records in order to cooperate with the Justice Department as it begins this investigation.
Mike, do you have any idea of how all this is affecting the morale at the CIA?
I think that Vincent could probably speak to that much more than I can. I can only guess and speculate based on what we see in print. And clearly there is unhappiness all the way up to the director of the CIA about the way that this whole process has gone, both pre-war and post-war.
Vince?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Mike's view on that. The morale is not very good. There has been a feeling that the intelligence community and the professionals in the intelligence community have been poorly used by the administration, in many cases sidetracked, belittled, demeaned, and in some cases pressured significantly by visits of very senior officials out to CIA headquarters, insisting on points of view that the CIA has not adopted very strongly. The question of the uranium acquisition in Africa, in Niger, by Saddam Hussein was an issue that was visited by the Vice President of the United States in two separate visits to CIA headquarters. Newt Gingrich, who doesn't have any real official standing, went out to CIA on the same subject, question of Iraqi WMD. There was a great deal of political pressure exerted on the agency, and I think a lot of the career professionals felt intimidated and beset. And it was certainly the results of the war in that there have been no stockpiles of weaponized chemicals or weaponized biologicals found tend to give the intelligence professionals a certain, I told you so kind of attitude. But clearly they are feeling a bit more vindicated now than they were before.
What does this mean for relations between the White House and the intelligence community?
Very poor. I think it means that you had the attempt, for example, of the White House to blame George Tenet and have George Tenet take the fall on the issue of those famous words, 16 words, in the State of Union address saying that Iraq had been trying to acquire yellowcake uranium in Niger. Condi Rice's first remark was that this was CIA's responsibility. Later investigation showed that it was her own staff that insisted on putting those words into the State of the Union address while George Tenet had tried to have them removed. So clearly there has been a feeling that the agency has been misused and a lot of the professionals. But the professionals don't give George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, a free ride on this issue as well. I mean, the career professionals feel that they haven't been defended strongly enough in the policy-making councils.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Vince Canestraro is a former CIA chief of counterterrorism operations and analysis. And thanks also NPR's correspondent Mike Schuster. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
You're welcome, Lynn.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.